Hello and welcome. This is Take Two from your friends at KermodandMayo.com. Correspondence.
Your friends Kermode and Mayo?
It doesn't really work, does it? But I'm just, it's a general introduction.
But your friends at Kermode and Mayo, it's like saying, this is your friends at Tony and Paul. This is your friends. It's like, we are your friends.
We are your friends.
Do you play that on Great Sits Radio?
We do play that. In fact,
we've been observing
this is you. The Carpenters.
I've never realised before that actually sounds like Frank Sidebottom.
Calling occupants.
And one night we'll make a contact with you.
Yeah, that was a cover version.
No.
The Carpenters calling occupants of... I forget now, though, our top production team are now jumping to attention. That's not the original.
I had no idea.
Well, I mean, I could do it, actually. Why should I... Because this is Take Two, and we've been told that, you know, we can take our time.
A popular Radio 1 DJ who was not you...
I'm not connected.
I'll look it up. Hang on. Who was not you did a long joke, the punchline of which was Colin knocks 2 pence off into planetary's craft. And it took such a long time to get to that punchline that I think by the time it happened, Calling Occupants of Interplanetary Craft, song by the Carpenters, Wikipedia, is a power ballad by the Canadian rock band Klaatu.
There you go, Klaatu.
Where does Klaatu come from?
Outer space.
Day the Earth Stood Still. Well, I mean, Klaatu, yes. Yeah, Day the Earth Stood Still. Originally released in 1976 on their first album, 347 EST. Wow, they knew how to...
To sell.
Come up with the title.
That's why we only remember the version by the Carpenters.
It opened night transmission of the pirate radio station Radio Caroline.
There you go. So the Carpenters didn't do it first. Anyway, that was the point.
I had no idea. Well, I've learned something new. What was the other thing that I learned? The gerrymandering.
Gerrymandering, which you told you all about.
This is basically like an educational service.
Thank you. An email from Dr. Jonathan J. Negus, PhD, MA, Cantab, MSc, MBBS. MRCS, FRACS, and FAAuth-A. Dear Big Hero 6 and Ex Machina, from a heritage listener and robotic surgeon.
Oh, fantastic, right.
In response to your request to hear from surgeons who use robots in surgery.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'd be more than happy to pitch in. I am an orthopaedic surgeon specialising in hip and knee surgery, and I use a robot for joint replacements. The robots we use in surgery are not true robots. They are all controlled by the human operator rather than just pressing a go button and letting them do the operation like a car assembly robot.
No, sure, yeah.
In orthopaedics, the robots consist...
We never suggested for one minute...
It's not Terminator.
It's like, you know, they go off and... Yeah.
In orthopaedics, the robots consist of a computer connected to a very accurate set of cameras that visualise trackers fixed to the patient's bones, which locates the knee or hip joint in space and keeps track of them as they move.
Is the hip joint connected to the...
Yes, almost certainly. Once I've programmed in the exact depth and angle of bony cuts that I want to make, the robotic arm with a saw blade or reamer, it's a spinning cheese grater, apologies to Mark... or reamer attached, will only allow me to cut or ream in that exact plane. I still have to move the arm into position and operate the device, but it makes my work extremely precise.
So that sounds rather like the way that it works when you're key cutting. You have to do it yourself, but it cuts in the exact shape of the key because you've got the...
Maybe so. For other branches of surgery, such as general, cardiovascular and urological, there is a robot called the Da Vinci that was referenced by your previous email correspondent. It has multiple arms and allows for very delicate and precise movements within the body's various cavities.
Is that because Da Vinci painted people with multiple arms?
Through very small incisions, hence keyhole. This robot's arms eliminate any tremor and excessive movements. The surgeon still sits separate to the robot in a little control booth. Makes it sound like an end of the pier... device. And sometimes this can be even remotely, in other words, another room or even another country. We are still not at the place...
Isn't science amazing?
Incredible. We are still not at the place where we just press go and let the robot do the surgery, although I'm sure it's heading that way. Like planes without pilots, the biggest hurdle to that development is for people to feel comfortable without a human at the controls.
Yes.
And on behalf of all surgeons working today, thank goodness for now. Says Dr. Jonathan J. Negus. I would be absolutely in there with, I don't want you to press button and then robot takes
over. I'd like you to stay.
Thank you very much. By the way, having just watched Terminator 3 again,
yes.
Claire Danes is in it. Pardon me. Claire Danes is in it.
Well done. Nicely played. Claire Danes is in it. Yes, that's right.
Yes, which I'd completely forgotten if I'd even known. Dominic Weston in Shepton Mallet. Dear Wavy Bill and Brittle Cora, I think I'm an undiagnosed MTL and grade one violin survivor, having failed a supposedly unfailable exam in junior school.
Yeah.
Anyway, childhood musical trauma aside, my ears pricked up when you referred to Claire Danes, again, as miscast in the film-adjacent series The Essex Serpent.
Yes.
In an effort to expand our cinematic vocabulary, such as third act, could you elaborate on whether being miscast is an actual recognised thing or a polite euphemism for not having the range to perform a role as well as it should be to bring a character to life? I'm not trying to be critical of anyone's talent. I'm genuinely interested to know whether producers and directors and casting agents go into a project knowing that they will have problems with a particular actor's range of skills, or if they believe that with the right level of support, direction and time, any actor can inhabit any role.
So, weirdly enough, I've spoken to a few casting directors, and it's always that question about, are you looking for range, or are you looking for something that the person has that is in some way, you know, chimes with the role? And although it is true that, you know, a great actor can be great across a range of roles, it is also true that a casting director has to have an eye for why somebody might be able to suit a particular role particularly well. And I think that it's an alchemical thing. It's really, really, I mean, casting directors are the great unsung heroes of, I'm sure television, but you know, I'm thinking specifically of film, because so many directors have said, look, once the cast is in place, the film will kind of run with its own momentum, because the trick is to cast it properly and then work with that. And the casting process, particularly when you're casting young actors, is very, very alchemical. But I think it goes right up into established actors. I just feel like that role wasn't quite right for Claire Danes. And I was fascinated to discover that you said she wasn't originally cast for it.
I did hear an interview also with Sarah Perry, who wrote the book, in which she said she was absolutely perfect. And even allowing for the fact that obviously an author is going to be supportive of the televised version, she sounded, and it's her character, as though Claire Danes was absolutely perfect.
That's
fine. So the character that she wanted was exactly as portrayed.
Yeah, okay.
So I think that's probably worth saying. Dominic signs off by saying, on the other end to miscast, are there any genuine cast in ones, by which I think he means just absolutely reliable dead certs? I think, he says, Monica Dolan is an unsung hero who is absolutely able to transform herself within roles, from a terrifying Rose West in Appropriate Adult to the hilarious senior BBC communication officer Tracy Pritchard in W1A, and loads of roles in between.
Monica Dolan is fantastic, and Monica Dolan is one of those people, I mean, a little like Kate Dickie, to whom I struggle to think of her ever having not been great in something, regardless of the quality of what she's been in.
She was also married to Ray Fiennes in Dig. Yeah. Ray Fiennes is Basil Brown, was it? And also married to Eddie Marsan in The Thief, his wife, and The Canoe, which was on television.
In which she absolutely is perfect, although it's not like any other role that she's played. So, you know, I think she's amazing. I think she's absolutely amazing. That's a very, very good call. She is an amazing actor.
And Dominic says, down with the worst and up with the usual, which is fine. But that's worth saying, actors like Monica Dolan, who you go, couldn't do almost anything.
Yes, although obviously, as I said, there is a certain thing about matching actors to roles. I'll give you an example. Okay, this isn't a very good example, but it's an example. When I was at Manchester University, I ended up being in a production of the Rocky Horror Show. This is back in the 80s, it's a long time ago. And I auditioned for the role of Frank, okay, because everybody auditioned for the role of Frank. And literally the person who was directing it took one look at me and went, Brad. And I went, not Frank. He went, no.
Get away.
No, you're Brad. And you know what? They're right. There was no way I was ever, I mean, I wasn't a great actor anyway, but there was no way I was ever going to play for them. And clearly,
were a good Brad.
Yeah, I was a perfect Brad. It was absolutely, that was a role that was tailor-made for me.
Dear correspondents and correspondents, listening to Take Two, I couldn't help but notice, this is from Thomas Leakins, I couldn't help but notice you trying to pronounce the name of the star of Loft, Bullhead, Rust and Bone and Far From the Madding Crowd. Being from the same country, Belgium, and even the same city, Antwerp, as this actor, I thought I'd help. I refer you to the recording attached to this email. Glad to be of assistance. Up with all feminists and down with all Nazis.
Before you play it, can I tell you how I think it should be, how I think it should be pronounced? And I haven't heard this recording yet, okay? I think he is Matthias Schoenaerts.
I would have said Matthias Schoenaerts. So that's our two different takes.
Let's
a
hear.
Take one and a take two. Here is what Thomas has sent us.
Matthias Schoenaerts.
Not even close. Okay, no. Not even close.
No, I think we need that.
Not even close.
Let's can we take that again? Let's hear it again.
Matthias Schoenaerts.
Okay, Matthias, so the first thing is it's Matthias. So the emphasis is on
Matthias.
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 And then, okay, so that's the first Matthias.
No, but he says Matthias. It's okay. Almost like Muttley.
Do it
say it again.
Matthias Schoenaerts.
Schoenaerts. It's Schoon.
No, not Schoon. Schoon.
No, it's. He says he's got an R in it.
No, he hasn't.
Yes, he has.
Play it again.
Matthias Schoenaerts.
Schoenaerts.
No, he hasn't got an R. He's got.
He says Schoenaerts.
No, he doesn't. He goes Schoenaerts.
He says.
It's no R.
He doesn't.
He makes a sound with the back of his throat.
He does. Play it again.
Matthias Schoenaerts.
Schoenaerts.
He doesn't say Schoenaerts.
He does.
If you were more erudite, you'd know that he doesn't say that. And he's listening right now, throwing things at his Apple device.
And he's saying, Simon is absolutely right.
It's not a R sound, it's a H sound. Schoenaerts.
I'm not taking pronunciation guides from you.
No, well, that's fair enough.
But thank you, Thomas, for really clearing that up. Because the next time Matthias Schoenaerts needs a mention, we'll get him absolutely
I did always
sorted.
Think it was like Schoenough, you know.
It's Matthew Schoenough.
Matthew
Schoenough. He's back.
He is. I've got all his records.
Okay. Let me see. What's this? Dear Mr. Mayo. Hello, Mr. Mayo and Doctor in the TARDIS. This is Jacob in Hampshire.
Hello, Jacob in Hampshire.
Fairly new listener here. Alas, the mantle of heritage has not been bestowed onto me yet, but already a big fan of you too. And he doesn't mean you too. He means us.
Oh, sorry. I thought you meant a big fan of you too.
No, he's already a big fan of you too. Meaning yeah, he's addressing us.
Great.
I listened to your podcast whilst working at a warehouse packing home delivery orders. Your often witty and whimsical digressions make me laugh, much to the confusion, no doubt, of my onlooking managers who must be wondering why I'm laughing at an avocado. Apologies if this question has absolutely nothing to do with relevant features and thus derails the very intricate, seamless execution of the show. But I was wondering the following.
Mm-hmm.
I watched Amadeus again recently.
Amadeus.
And was once Amadeus. More blown away for nearly 3 solid hours.
Yep.
The acting, the attention to detail, the soundtrack, the scene where Mozart and Salieri composed the former's Requiem, the hair... It made me pen a love letter to the film in an arts magazine I edit for my university. I just adore it.
Is it headlined Nipples of Venus?
Could have been. In fact, in the director's
I know.
Cut.
I know.
Yes.
This is something which has stayed with you.
I'm aware that Mr. Mayo's favourite film has been off-quoted as Amadeus, but I can't say I've heard what Mark thinks of it.
Yes.
Has he seen it?
Of course.
I mean, obviously he has. And if so, what does he make of it? Please tell me immediately. I simply must know. Thank you, says Jacob in Hampshire, and have an almighty day.
Well, I mean, of course I've seen it because we refer quite often to Too Many Notes.
We do.
Too Many Notes, Your Majesty. And there it is. Because some of his kingly stuff is some of the funniest stuff I've ever seen. I think the scene when, after Salieri plays the thing that he's written for, you know...
It's Mark playing the piano on a wooden table, by the way, in case you're wondering what the rumbling is.
And then he sits down... What's the name of the actor?
Matthias Schoenaerts.
No, the guy who plays Amadeus.
It's Tom Hulse.
Tom Hulse, thank you. Sits down and he says, no, it's all right, I have it here. And he says, oh, would you like to demonstrate? And he starts playing it and he goes, it doesn't quite work, does it?
It's brilliant.
And then he does, it's just genius. It's absolute genius. And too many notes.
It is fantastic. In fact, and this is for a future program, I interviewed Tom Hanks yesterday, and you'll hear that interview.
I'm looking forward to Elvis, the film as well.
And I really want, you're the Elvis aficionado, so we're interested to know what you make of it. But I said, one of the things I said to Tom Hanks was, there's a feeling of Amadeus about Elvis.
Okay.
In as much as it's a biopic, sure, because the guy's name is in the title.
Yeah.
But in the same way that Amadeus, you see Mozart's life through Salieri, we're seeing Elvis through Colonel Tom Parker. So anyway. I look forward to hearing your views on that film and what you think.
Do they have Colonel Tom doing the chicken dancing on a hot tin routine?
No, I don't think they do.
That was one of his old carny tricks.
They've certainly got. Anyway, it's very Baz Luhrmann, and that's for a future program. I think that's coming out in a few weeks' time.
Okay, cool.
Anyway. Mark and Simon, very long-time Heritage listener, occasional emailer. This is Neil Graham, 43 and two-thirds. In the past, I've emailed to chip in with my two penny worth about a film. If you'll forgive the cheek, I'd like to do it this time, about your newfangled show thingy. What is this?
This thing?
I've just finished listening to the Take Two episode of your live show, and it was quite simply note perfect. This has all been redacted, by the way. It was like watching Toy Story 3 or the Mary Poppins sequel, desperately hoping that they're not going to muck it up and spoil everything, and then sinking into your seat with a sigh of pleasure and relief as the world is made right again. So big thank you from this ultra or vanguardist or whatever it is I am. 10 more years, please, from Neil Graham. P.S. I realise virtually all of this is likely to be redacted, so if it helps with the censor, and then there's some comments about the showrunner, but I can't read those. No,
they're illegible on mine as well, so.
Email.
It's a shame.
Correspondence at kermitandmayo.com. Before we go on, just a note on Take It or Leave It, You Decide, which is a fabulous idea. This is where you're recommending must-sees, things that you've seen.
Things that we may have missed.
Yeah, exactly, because there's so much media out there, it's easy for us to not do everything that you love. So it's word of mouth on a podcast. And you talked about Heartstopper on Netflix a couple of shows back.
Which Pachinko, I really liked.
When we were the chapel at the church, which is on Apple TV. Plus, next week, Jamie got in touch with us for You Decide, and he said Undone on Amazon Prime has to be seen. So that's what you're going to be doing next week. So if you are a fan or if you've seen it and given up or whatever your thoughts on Undone, if you've got Amazon Prime, please get in touch and we'll include you on the programme next week, correspondence at kermitandmayo.com. One Frame Back is this feature which is exclusive for the Vanguardist, is where we explore films connected in some way to other stuff that we've been talking about. So Mark reviewed Pistol on Take One. And in fact, you've mentioned a bunch of punkish films.
And whilst talking about Pistol.
Of course. And so obviously you're going to enhance and expand our viewing for a great punk film. But this is what the Witter Takeys have been recommending this week for One Frame Back. So we're going to add this to our library watch list.
I'm going to leap in as you do these rather than because it's...
Someone who I think I'm going to pronounce Juflu says, good vibrations, if only for that scene, which inevitably makes me cry, even out of context, one of the best, if not the best, needle drop in the history of film. This is the Terry Hooley record shot.
I absolutely love Good Vibrations, and I'm sure that the scene you're referring to is when John Peel plays Teenage Kicks on the radio for the first time, and that, you know, it's happening, and they've all missed it. They turns on the radio and they've missed it, and then John Peel goes, "Oh, that was so wonderful! I think I'm just going to play it again." Bump, and then it goes into Good Vibrations, and Terry Hooley goes out into the street, and there's this. It's an army helicopter, you know, shining a because it's the Troubles, and you know, shining this spotlight, and it's like the finger of God pointing down him. It's an absolutely brilliant. I love that film. It is such a great film,
so
and it really stands up.
Juflu also says Green Room. As a punk frontman, the first 10 minutes were almost autobiographical for me, and the fear of having the wrong kind of alternative audience in front of you is always present. Although luckily my experience never reached the Pitbulls and Shotguns level of this film, which I haven't seen, but it's Imogen Poots, Patrick Stewart and Anton Yelchin.
Yeah, it's a really good film. I reviewed it and I told you what my review of it was, which you've completely got out of your head, obviously. Yeah. But it's really well worth seeing. And as is Blue Ruin by the same director.
Sophio Galacticos says, ladies and gentlemen, The Fabulous Stains. Very entertaining film about a trio of schoolgirls forming their own band with a very young Laura Dern. So that's back in 1982.
Yeah, which is, one of those films that people have probably forgotten about, but is actually well worth checking out.
Laura Dern, who is in the new Jurassic movie and I discussed with Jeff Goldblum.
Does Jeff Goldblum talk like Jeff Goldblum still? He's absolutely full Jeff.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Sue Sorensen says, Penelope Spheris' The Decline of Western Civilization, made in 81. when it was still sort of happening. A documentary that gets the mess and mayhem and make it up as we go along feeling of punk also shows some real ugliness before the genre was cleaned up and made presentable.
And, of course, Penelope Spheeris would go on to direct Wayne's World.
Joe McCartney says Brian Gibson's 1980 film Breaking Glass is an absolute gem of a movie. Watched it first on home video. Hazel O'Connor's performance was totally breathtaking. Bittersweet memories still linger after all this time.
I think there's a question about whether or not Breaking Glass counts as a punk rock movie because it's post-punk. It's kind of futuristic. You remember when the beginning was a world? Man said, let there be more light. You remember all that stuff? Mm-hmm. Two big hit singles from it. One of them was, I said, behold what I have done. I'm doing the movements because she does it on stage. Paul Gambaccini, when reviewing the film on Radio 1, I think, said it was one of the very few times that he'd seen a gig in a film that he wished he'd been at. Hmm. And also, Stay Now, you know, the one
Will
with,
You.
With Will You. That's right, it was called Will You, that's right, which was a huge big hit single. I think that Breaking Glass is a creakier piece of work than Joe McCartney suggests, but there are things in it that do stick in the mind, not least that performance when they do, you know, the Eighth Day or whatever it's called.
And David Dunn says, shout out for Rock and Roll High School because, you know, the Ramones, Joe Dante, PJ Souls. What would be your choice, Mark?
Well, the one that,
one frame back,
the
one,
one
film.
That nobody's picked up is, which is surprising, is the punk rock movie, which is the Don Letts movie, which is kind of the original ground zero document of the punk movement. And Don Letts, who, there was a documentary about Don Letts' life just recently. And there's a wonderful story in it that he tells, and he, you know, I've spoken to him in person as well. He tells the same story that the way he ended up directing the punk rock movie was that he was filming a whole load of.
And it's called the punk rock movie.
It's called the punk rock movie, yeah. And it is, it's the kind of sump. It's where it all begins. And it happened because Don Letts, who had been shooting stuff on a Super 8 camera and, you know, filming stuff because he was Don Letts. And then he read in the NME, Don Letts is making a punk rock movie. And he went, that's a good idea. That's how it happened.
That is very good. You know how you tell stories which you might have told before?
Yes, all the time.
I'm sure I've told you this before, but Don Letts said to me, it was a book that I'd written, and one of the main plot reveals was the opening line from Bank Robber by The Clash.
Yes.
Okay. And I said, and it was at some event, some function, and I said to Don, look, do you think The Clash will be all right with that? He said, they'll be fine.
They'll be fine.
Don't worry
about
they'll
it. They'll be fine. What could possibly?
Yeah. So on the day that the book is being printed, literally when it's at the printers and they're pressing the button, I get a phone call from the editor of the book saying, the Clash's lawyers haven't given us permission. We have to change it. I said, but it's a plot reveal. I said, you have to rewrite it. So walking down the street in London's W1, I rewrote the line because the Clash's lawyers didn't let me use that.
So what
line.
Did you rewrite
so Don
it
Letts,
as?
So Don Letts, it had to be something like a conversation between two people in which instead of saying, Daddy was a bank robber, which was the line that I was trying to get
yeah.
to, it was, it's a song, someone says, you said, it's a song about a bank robber and his dad. Or something, which you can say because, anyway.
He didn't say he fought the law and the law won.
No, I thought about fighting the law, but publisher's lawyers said, you've got to be kidding.
Yes.
Which is, although my favourite version of that song is Jello Biafra from Dead Kennedys. Yeah. He's got a recording, which is, I fought the law and I won, except he didn't and he went to prison. So there you go. So our one frame back is generally available. Is it the punk rock film? Would I be able to find that, do you think, quite easily?
You know, I'm going to throw this over to the top production team and ask Simon Poole to look it up. And whilst he looks it up, I'm going to tell you that Good Vibrations, of all of the movies in terms of the ones
that have been mentioned.
Yeah. Good Vibrations is such a brilliant piece of work. It is such a great film. I mean, I've met the real Terry Hooley. I told you this story before, but sorry, since we're telling old stories, we did a gig at the Black Box in Belfast, which we played quite a lot. This is the Dodge Brothers. And the Black Box is a great venue to play. There's a really great rocking scene in Belfast, which is brilliant. And we had two shows. We had one in the afternoon and one in the evening. And just before the afternoon show, somebody said, Terry Hooley's in the crowd and he'd like to come and say hello. And I said, that'd be great. I'd love to meet Terry Hooley. And they said, no. I said, why? I'd love to meet Terry. He said, no, you can meet Terry Hooley after the gig. Because if you meet him before the gig, you won't go on stage for at least an hour and a half.
Oh, okay, right. Fair enough.
And then afterwards, I met Terry, and they're right. I mean, you've never met a man so full of stories. It's absolutely just like a walking, talking book.
Fantastic. Let's assume that Yeah, let's assume that all of these films are widely available.
I've just heard in my ears from Simon, the controller, that the punk rock movie is widely available.
He didn't work very hard on that answer,
did he? No, he didn't. He just
Googled it. Okay, now next week, Mark is reviewing Jurassic World Dominion.
Yes.
Jurassic World Dominion. So we're going to be picking a Jeff Goldblum film to add to your watch list. So,
okay, can I choose one?
Well, I guess
The Mad Monkey.
I mean, we're going to be doing this next week mainly.
The Mad Monkey.
The Mad Monkey.
The Mad Monkey. Can we please talk about The Mad Monkey? It is the great overlooked Jeff Goldblum film.
Your contributions will be welcome.
Contributions, but as long as they are The Mad Monkey.
At kermitandmayo.com. But obviously, yes. There's no point in you saying The Mad Monkey because you are going to do The Mad Monkey.
I'm going to do The Mad Monkey. Say whatever you want. I'm going to do The Mad Monkey.
So,
I'm going to do The Mad Monkey sounds like I'm going to do the ostrich, or I'm going to do the...
I'm going to go and have a poo is what it sounds like. I'm going to do The Mad Monkey.
No, it doesn't sound anything like that. It sounds like a dance move from the 1950s. It doesn't sound anything like a try-hard. Where your mind works,
excellent.
Mayo. Everyone thinks you're nice, but actually you're just cesspit.
Okay, so we're going to spoil everything in just a moment. But before we get there, Mark, what else are you going to tell us about?
A new film, which is called Major, which is a biographical drama inspired by the real life story of Sandeep Unnikrishnan, who was posthumously, awarded the Ashoka Chakra, which is India's highest peacetime gallantry award, following his actions during the November 2008 Mumbai attacks. He led a team of commandos in an operation to save hostages being held in the Taj Mahal Palace Hotel. And according to the citation for the award, it said, Major Sandeep Unnikrishnan led the commando operation launched on the 27th of November 2008 to flush out terrorists from the Hotel Taj Mahal, Mumbai, in which he rescued 14 hostages. During the operation, his team came under intense hostile fire, in which one of his team members was grievously injured. Major Sandeep pinned down the terrorists with accurate fire and rescued the injured commando to safety. In the process, he was shot in the right arm. Despite his injuries, there's a point to reading all this out. Despite his injuries, he continued to fight the terrorists till the last breath. Major Sandeep Unnikrishnan displayed most conspicuous bravery besides camaraderie and leadership of the highest order, and made the supreme sacrifice for the nation. And so a figure of obvious modern legend, a remarkable story in real life. On screen, it plays like utter fiction. Basically, it's Adivi Sesh plays Major Sandeep as a cross between James Bond and Bruce Willis in Die Hard. Everything is massively overcooked and massively overcranked. The dialogue, the action, the romance, the score, which kind of starts at a point of big and then in that Michael Bolton way goes up from there. And during some of the kind of the most extended sequences during the siege, the score is just going bananas.
Are you featuring it on your top soundtrack?
Featuring
show?
A song from it, but okay. Not. Yeah, I'm still trying to get hold of the orchestral, but there is a song that we're featuring from it on Scarlet. Thank you for bringing that up. The film it has dramatic punch. I mean, the problem is that the way in which the story is told is so generically action movie that you have to keep reminding yourself that behind it is a real story. In many ways, you kind of think, well, I'd actually be quite interested in seeing the absolutely down-to-earth real story. But, you know, it does what it sets out to do. It's a film about somebody being unbelievably heroic that's told in unbelievably heroic movie terms. And as I said, absolutely everything is huge. Don't expect subtlety. Don't expect understatement. Don't expect one ending. But it does what it says in the tin. It's called Major, and it's in cinemas now.
I thought it might be like a biopic of John Major.
That would be a very different film, wouldn't it?
It would be quite a different take indeed. Mark and Simon spoil everything. So instead of... I'm going to do a comically short spoiler description of the film. But
okay.
I think, first of all, we should have a clip.
Thank you. So I was a little surprised you asked Christy for my number.
What is that?
Aren't you married?
Well, yeah, but what? Married people can't have friends?
We're gonna be friends?
Yeah. You wanna be my friend?
We're not going to be friends.
But they are friends of this show, of course, as they've both been on.
They have both been on.
Many times. Getting on famously. See, that everything that you're... I know what you think about it, and we've got emails about it.
Sure.
Their acting performances are fine in it. And Margot Robbie is very good and Leonardo DiCaprio is very good. Anyway.
Well, they are good actors.
So here's my description of the film.
Okay.
An annoying idiot is enticed into the drug-fueled New York stockbroker culture. Following Black Monday, he loses his job, so sets up a dodgy, hard-selling penny shares company which specialises in pump and dump. The annoying idiot becomes enormously financially successful and slides into a life of engaging prostitutes and consuming large quantities of drugs. Inevitably, he has an affair and gets divorced. Annoying idiot then makes even more money. The FBI wiretap his phone. He has a fight with his friend. His boat capsizes, his plane is destroyed, and he tries to get off the drugs. Someone informs on the annoying idiot there's a very unpleasant cocaine-fueled scene with his wife in which he assaults her. He crashes his car. The annoying idiot wears a wire to work for the FBI, but tells everyone that he's wearing a wire. He gets arrested, is trialed, sentenced to 36 months in a minimum security prison, and is released after serving 22 months. Anything to add?
Well, yes. I look back at the review that I wrote at the time when this first came out, and I had completely forgotten this. This is how I began my review of The Wolf of Wall Street when it first opened. In 1929, the New York Times' motion picture critic, Mordaunt Hall, opined, "The Wolf of Wall Street is a talking feature that is currently decorating the Rialto. It causes one to sigh. This yarn is not materially different from other Wall Street tales that have come to the screen. Money there is, also madness, women and swindling. Such a state of affairs. Oh dear, oh dear." And I did think when I read that, wow, that's basically me reviewing The Wolf of Wall Street, the different. There's no connection between the films at all, other than the fact that they share that title.
And also, oh dear, oh dear.
And
words.
Oh dear, oh dear. The sense that it's... We've seen this before. We've seen it done better. My main problem with it is I think that Martin Scorsese is showing us, you know, a world of, you know, putrid corruption and people who I absolutely detest. But the movie appears to be enjoying itself much too much. And that just for me just kept me constantly distanced. I mean, I suppose one could argue that the moral victory is I hated Jordan Belfort. There was no part...
Quite appropriately.
Yeah, and one could say, well, therefore the film worked. The film worked because you came out of it hating Jordan Belfort. The difference is I don't know whether I hated it because the film wanted me to hate him or whether I hated him because I hate him and no matter what the film did, you know... I mean, did you find him at all in any way interesting or seductive or...
Well, he can be interesting, seductive and hateful.
He can be.
Because clearly he was all those because that's why he was so successful, but he was still a scumbag.
Yeah, but did you find spending that time in the company of him that you... Did you find it edifying? Did you find it uplifting? Did you find it entertaining?
I didn't find it edifying. I was... you know, it's a well-made... It's a well-acted, well-made... film, and I enjoyed the performances in there. So maybe
but there's
I enjoy-
a huge but in that sentence.
Yeah, but there's, you know,
but it is the story of somebody in whose company I could happily spend no time ever.
Yes,
and
of course.
And what did it tell you about the character that you didn't know when you went in?
I didn't really know anything about him.
No, I didn't know anything. But you know, the first 5 minutes when he starts narrating his story, you go, "Oh, okay, you're an absolute rotter."
Cad.
Yes. And you're not somebody... You're somebody I would cross the road to avoid.
Here's an email.
And yet I'm going to have to listen to you narrating your story.
Otis says, "Mark and Simon, in light of this week's episode, I thought I'd go back and watch Wolf of Wall Street."
Okay.
So this is... Otis is hardcore. You know, in the vanguard, he's the most vanguardy of the vanguardians.
Yeah. I'd like to say you did more than I did because I just went back and read my review because I actually don't have enough life space to... bother to watch Wolf of Wall Street again.
It was a few years since I saw it for the first time in 2015. What immediately struck me about the film...
First time, only time. You've only seen it once.
...was an air of... I'm reading his email.
No. Oh, sorry. You were saying that you... I thought you went and saw it again?
No, this
no,
is...
No, yes, fine.
Okay, this is...
You're reading...
I'm still reading...
This is something that the listener wrote in.
Otis, like I said.
Yeah, fine. Okay.
So there's an email from Otis.
I'm sorry, but...
"In light of this week's episode, I thought I'd go back and watch Wolf of Wall Street again. It's been a few years since I saw it for the first time in 2015.
Got it.
What immediately struck me about the film was an air of complete soullessness. It is a film about somebody knowingly doing something terrible, continuing to do so in the knowledge that he is destroying livelihoods. And all the while, Jordan Belfort himself continues to rake in earnings from the film and has seemingly done very well as a result of its release. Am I missing something here, or is this not completely vile? In comparison, a film character like Arthur Fleck, Joker, suffers a complete breakdown, goes on a killing spree, and yet is completely pitiful, not sympathetic, as Mark rightly points out in his review. Belfort, on the other hand, is just repulsive. The Wolf of Wall Street is so loaded with offensive ideas and characters that for it not to give the audience a reason to buy into those ideas and characters begs the question, what's the point in the film at all? I look forward to enjoying your wonderful podcast for years to come. Cheers to what has been and what is yet to come. Yours sincerely, Otis.
This is, I'm completely on the same page as you. I'm just going through this review that I wrote when it came out. As for The Wolf of Wall Street, you wind up realizing that there's a very good reason why no classic movie ever opened with the words, as far back as I can remember, I always wanted to be a stockbroker, which I thought was actually... I'm sorry, I just made myself laugh. I threw myself a joke so many years ago, I've forgotten it.
That's amazing. So you've laughed at your own joke?
I have laughed at my own joke.
7 years later?
Yeah. I'm also remembering that the Bacchanalian scenes, I did indeed compare them to Stanley Kubrick's Eyes Wide Shut, which incidentally is not meant as a compliment because Eyes Wide Shut is far and away Kubrick's worst film. But there's the whole thing about the soullessness is right. It feels like a mechanical exercise. Now, somebody could say, well, what would you expect a film about somebody who is soulless to be like? And my question would be, why make it? I mean, I think actually it's one of the very few films in which my question is actually, why does it exist? What does it bring to the world that makes it better? If, as Roger Ebert said, cinema is a machine for creating empathy, what is the point Wolf of Wall Street?
If it brings revulsion at the kind of excess that I was revolted by that anyway. I know, but what I mean is, but if it brings that revulsion to a wider audience, it's all right for you to be revolted about it. But if a mainstream cinema audience then become revolted by that kind of capitalism, then maybe it works.
But I don't know that that's the case. I suspect that it would be perfectly possible to watch it in the same way as it's possible to watch Entourage and buy into that kind of, nihilistic, let's just, F everybody and just, and just stick everything up our own nose. I mean, I don't know. Margot Robbie's very, very good. And it's a difficult role and she does a pretty good job of playing it. It completely sidelines its women characters. I mean, there is an interesting question about, there's a moment in the film when one of the fellow financiers, who's Kimmy Belzer, says she was one of the first brokers here, one of Stratton's originals, and she says how much, he's still. And you go, why have I not seen anything about her before? It's like, why is it that I'm only knowing this now? So there's a kind of interesting thing about there were other stories that could have been told around that, but I never heard any of them because all I heard was Leonardo DiCaprio's Jordan Belfort boring us all with his own tales of, girlfriends and hookers and everything else, I just feel like, yeah, I know that's all horrible. Why am I here?
So basically what it boils down to is, although you were revolted by it, you suspect that some other people might have gone and thought, oh, I quite like to be like
him. I think the film enjoys itself enough that it will be possible to enjoy the spectacle of the debauchery. And I'm sorry, I don't think there is anything enjoyable about that debauchery. I think it's absolutely, all the time I'm watching it, I'm just thinking, you are stealing money from, there's a moment in, to relate this back to something earlier on, there is a moment in Pistol, okay, in which, I think it's in the final episode, in Who Killed Bambi, in which Malcolm McLaren turns up and says, oh, my sexy pistols, or as I now like to call you, my pistoleros, because we're going to go to Buenos Aires, wherever it is, where they go to go Ronnie Biggs. Where does that happen?
Brazil.
Yeah, we're going to go to Brazil and meet Ronnie Biggs. And Steve Jones goes, oh, thank heaven for that. Get us out of the South of America. Go somewhere nice. And John Rotten goes, Ronnie Biggs attacked a working, a hard-working working class man and left him with, you know, permanently disabled, which obviously was always the argument about why you're glorifying.
Exactly.
Yep, precisely. Now, whether or not John Lydon actually said that at the time, I'm sure he just thought it was an absolutely terrible idea, because it was an absolutely terrible idea.
Correct.
But it's exactly that. It's like, yeah, I wouldn't want, I'm not interested. I'm just not interested. You are a loathsome slug who stole from people who could least afford to lose money. That's how you made your millions, and I actually have no time for you.
Thank you very much indeed.
Sorry,
No, that's fine. We're running out of tape now. We've been recording at 15 IPS, and if we'd gone at 7.5,
we would have been fine.
But we're absolutely, we're off the spool, as the kids say. Thank you once again for subscribing. We'll be back more with extra stuff next week. Mark, I hope you have a really, really good week. I'm already looking forward to next Wednesday.
Yes, what happens next Wednesday?
You'll be here again.
No, but for the listener, it's...
Oh, yeah. I'm really looking forward to Thursday, to midnight on Thursday. I'm really looking forward to our next recording when we come in with more reels of tape and we start again playing press and play and record. Please bring in the China glass.
Press and record. That's right. Yeah.
Record over the old ones.
Record over the old ones.
Yes.
Like they used to do.
Yes. Here is a historic episode of Doctor Who. Let's record over it to make a new one.
Because let's face it,
no one's
once they've gone out, no one wants them.
No one cares.